Well, first, thank you all for coming. I'm really delighted that you're here, and because Herr Priebes has a limited window of time with us, I'm not going to take much to introduce him. He's very well known, of course, to all of you, dedicated to help facilitate something that's important for America, not just for Europe, and that's to help facilitate a path by which Southeast Europe becomes part of all of Europe, and Europe in its fullest sense. And I would just like to say that that's very much in America's interest. And I'm delighted that we have at least one area between us and Europe where we think exactly alike. This is something we want to happen together, and we're working on it together. And that's a great thing. Reinhard Priebe is of course one of the big and prominent members of the establishment in Brussels with the EU, and has had many capacities in Brussels. And of course, it's now in this role that he's really, I think we've seen the culmination of why you want a person of this depth and character and talent at just the right moment for the EU as we're trying to work a very serious problem. Now, this is when you have an individual of this talent, you expect to hear sometimes tough messages, but that's what it's all about. And it's someone that wants a good outcome and is not Pollyannish about what it takes to get one. And that's the same thing we'd say as a friend who comes here to speak honestly with us about what we need to do to be a partner on a task that everybody wants to see accomplished. So without further delay, and may I just say, Reinhard, we're delighted you're here. Thank you for taking the time to be with us. I introduce to all of you His Excellency Reinhard Priebe from the European Union. Please, Reinhard.
Thank you very much, and thank you for these kind words, and thank you also for inviting me to this very important conference. Indeed, the period of stabilization is drawing to a close, as you have written in your invitation, and the states of Southeastern Europe face new challenges of economic reconstruction and regional cooperation. I understand that you had a very useful conference, and I have to apologize that I didn't attend the conference because I had other meetings, and we are looking forward for the conclusion of the conference, in particular those suggestions coming from the business world. Business people very often know much better than ourselves what is needed in the country. Now, I have to warn you, because I could speak about my subject in 2 minutes, in 5 minutes, in 1 hour, in 5 hours, and in 1 day. And I have, since time is short, to limit myself. And I want, first of all, to briefly explain to you our EU policy to Southeastern Europe. We start to prefer to speak about Southeastern Europe and no longer about the Western Balkans, which always has been quite a not designation of a geographical region. And then I will outline some points to you where I think which is most needed in the near future. Now, as you know, the European Commission last year proposed and announced that Bulgaria and Romania will join the European Union as from beginning of next year. So we will be 27 members. When I started to work in the European Commission, we were 11, 10, by the way, and even at that time, more senior colleagues thought that the club had become unworkable. Now we are heading for 27, and of course, my job is to reflect on what next. If I should explain to you our policy towards Southeastern Europe after the accession on the 1st of January 2007, I would highlight 3 points. First, European perspective. Secondly, conditionality. And then some explanations on our EU instruments, which we are used to get the countries towards membership. European perspective, what is that? It is a clear promise of the European Union that all the remaining countries in Southeast Europe will one day join the European Union. And this promise has been renewed only recently, and there's no doubt about that. Of course, it's a political promise, and it implies two things which are self-evident, but they need to be mentioned. It implies first that the countries want to join the club, and in saying that, I don't mean that they say it all the time, but there is a clear there is a clear political will to work on what is needed to do before you can join the community. And secondly, this European perspective promise implies that the countries meet the conditions for becoming member of the European Union. Now, conditionality, this is a very odd word, and not very much liked in the region, by the way, and it needs some explanation. First, it means that the European Union has, since its first accession in 1973, well-established conditions for becoming a member. And these conditions are laid down in our EU treaty, and they are more fine-tuned in what we call the Copenhagen criteria, which we subdivide in three categories, the political criteria, functioning democracy, basic standards of rule of law, independence of the judiciary, for example, basic standards of human rights. There are economic criteria. They are twofold. First, we want to have free market economy in the countries which want to adhere to our club, and we need a capability of the countries to cope with the EU internal market. And thirdly, the capability of the country to implement, to accept the what we call in a technocratic way the acquis communautaire, which is nothing else than the European legislation which we have worked out over the last 50 years. Now, I think one point has to be made very clear in relation to Southeast Europe, to the remaining non-member countries in the region. There will be no shortcuts. The European Union will insist on meeting the conditions for membership, and any hope that for any political reasons the European Union would be ready to lower its standards and to accept any shortcuts is simply unrealistic, and this has to be made very clear. That means, of course, that we are in a certain dilemma, that the leverage of accession for reform progress and for stability in the region is somewhat weakened by the fact that this process of meeting the accession criteria is inevitably for practically all countries a long process. And next point in relation to conditionality, we hear from time to time from the countries, you have invented new conditions for the Balkans to join. There are no new and no specific conditionalities for the Balkans, but there are specific problems. For example, refugee return, which we very much link to treating minorities and things like that, is not a new conditionality, but is a new problem which we haven't faced in other candidate countries. The cooperation with the Hague Tribunal is fulfilling international obligations and meeting basic standards of rule of law. It's not a new conditionality. This has to be made very clear. And finally, in relation to conditionality, the European Union cannot be blamed that it has learned some lessons from previous accessions and that we don't want to repeat mistakes we have made in the past. And one mistake we made in the past is that we didn't concentrate enough on the administrative implementation capacity of the countries. We were too much impressed in the early years of the accession of the 10 countries, the last accession, by nice pieces of legislation being published in official journal, and we only learned after some time that a piece of legislation published in official journal is not nothing, but is close to being nothing if it is not implemented. And that's why we are insisting so much with the Western Balkan countries on the implementation dimension. Now, we have a whole lot of instruments to get the countries close to accession. I will not explain them in detail. We don't have time for that. The stabilization and association process, which is the label for our pre-accession policy, is a whole set of instruments to prepare the countries for membership. Basically, it is liberalizing trade, a very generous assistance program, and stabilization and association countries. We want to get very quickly all the countries in an association relation, which means intensifying the relations with the countries on all EU-relevant areas to prepare them better for membership. And therefore, it's so important that all countries get into this network of stabilization and association agreements. We have two countries where the agreement is enforced, Croatia and Macedonia. We have one country where the agreement has been signed but not ratified, which is Albania. And we have two countries now with which we are in the process of negotiation, Bosnia and Herzegovina and Montenegro. And we have one country with which we have started negotiations but suspended them because of lack of cooperation with the Hague Tribunal, that is Serbia. But it is extremely important to get all countries as quickly as possible into this network. We have, of course, also a whole set of foreign policy instruments which are deployed on the Balkans, EU special representatives, police, military missions. I will not go into any detail. But the midterm and long-term policy framework is the stabilization and association process. And the simple and right, correct explanation of this process is just a set of instruments to prepare these countries for membership. So what is needed now at this stage? And I would mention there 5 points. First, we need to strengthen the regional dimension of the pre-accession process, and I think I understand this has been a subject of intensive discussions during this seminar. Regional cooperation amongst the countries is not only needed to achieve reconciliation in a region where there has been wars and civil wars, it is economic common sense. The countries are too small to work on economic agendas on their own. The whole region is smaller than Romania, and the biggest country in the region is a little bit smaller than Belgium, which we consider within our club as rather smaller than a bigger member state. So regional cooperation is essential, and we are very much insisting on that. And we are happy that considerable progress has been made over the last 2-3 years on this. We have seen last year a very important energy cooperation treaty, and we are close to an agreement amongst the countries about a free trade zone. The last final round, hopefully the last final round of negotiation, will take place later this month. So the region is starting to understand that regional cooperation is needed, and that, of course, means regional cooperation between all the countries in Southeast Europe, independently of the fact if they are already member states or not. So their EU status should not be relevant for this need of cooperation. One element of regional cooperation is, of course, that we want to move the Stability Pact, which is an internationally run body organizing regional cooperation, to a regionally owned body of regional cooperation, which would be the Southeastern European cooperation process. Many questions need to be solved yet, and it always comes down to very concrete things like where should the secretariat be located and who should be the secretary general. But it is extremely important that there is full regional ownership on regional dimension of the process. The second big issue which is open is the many open constitutional questions, and they have to be solved. The fact that the state building in that region has not been totally finished is, of course, a big difficulty, and it is something totally new for us in working with countries towards membership. Montenegro, as a new state, needs a new constitution. Serbia has just started the process on adopting a new constitution. By the way, in a process which, on the one hand, is high ownership, but is very discreet, and a bit more transparency on this process, which would have been welcome, if I might say so. In Bosnia and Herzegovina, we are facing a situation where the Dayton constitution is, I should not say unworkable, but there are elements in that which are certainly impediments for the country to move quickly towards European integration, and these problems have to be solved. Kosovo, after status, needs also a constitutional setup which has to be worked out. In Albania, the constitution is fine, but the constitutional reality is sometimes falling a little bit short, if I might say so. And at the end, even the name question in Macedonia is a constitutional question. So all these issues have to be worked out. And the European Union is normally quite discreet on these questions because we have in our own member states so many different constitutional setups that we are getting interested in that only if we see any constitutional rules which are contrary to EU law. So, but we need to work on constitutional reforms in nearly all of the countries of the region so that their constitutions are EU-fit, EU-open and EU-fit, and that the constitutional organization of the countries is affordable for the country. I don't think that, for example, Bosnia and Herzegovina can really afford the complicated setups they have in their current constitution. So it's also of a question of budgetary availabilities. Now, the next point I would highlight as an important point on which we have to concentrate is that the considerable deficits we see at different degrees, by the way, in all the countries in the area of rule of law have to be overcome. The judiciary, for example, is not working well in practically all countries, again, with different degrees. We don't have in all countries really independence of the judiciary. We don't have in many countries modern police services, and the standards of human rights are not yet at what we would like to see. There are huge problems, and it is not by accident that the European Commission proposed for Bulgaria and Romania very strong safeguards in relation to corruption. There's a high risk for the European Union that the use of funds will not be proper if the countries do not reduce the high degree of corruption. But corruption is, of course, not only a question of our funds, and it is much more a question of governance, culture, and it needs a cultural change in the administrations. So the area of rule of law is one of the areas on which we are concentrating very much in dealing with the countries. And that's what the foreign investors tell us. So if you ask a foreign investor or potential foreign investor, what are your problems in the countries? They say, well, judiciary is not functioning. There's high degree of corruption. There's legal uncertainty because the legislation is changing too often. There are two small economic spaces, and every 200 or 100 kilometers you get into a new country with a totally different legal setup. So economic operators, when you ask them what are the problems, 80% of the points they mention are rule of law problems. Then the next point, and here I come to the very subject of your conference, the economic situation in the countries. We have to work on further improvements, but we have also to note, and I understand that this has also been more or less the tone of this conference, that good progress has been made in the last years, and I think this is an area where we should perhaps more highlight the good news and the bad news. And we are happy that economies are recovering in the countries, again, at different degrees and with different problems. I mentioned that the regional dimension of economic development is very important. Political stability and legal security is another issue. And as I said, my experience is that the best advice we could get on what is needed for more quick economic development is asking foreign investors. I should mention here, although you might be surprised that I mentioned this under economic development, that the visa question is, of course, also something which has to be tackled. We know that the frustrations in all the countries on our high visa requirements are very, very big, and we understand that. It's a very difficult issue to work on, because there are a lot of hesitation in the EU member states to facilitate visa regimes at this moment. But we are very concretely working on this, and we are hoping that during 2007 we will see at least progress on the visa facilitation. We're not yet talking about visa liberalization. And the last point I wanted to highlight in this series of 5 points is that it is clear since the countries are moving to European membership that the EU will engage more and more. But it is too early to say that we do not need others to engage in the Western Balkans. The broad international community has not to step out at this moment, and certainly until the Kosovo status problem is settled, the international broader international engagement is still very much needed, and that includes the donor side of the engagement. Good donor coordination is essential, especially in a period where donor funds for the Western Balkans tend to decrease. The lower the funds, the better the coordination has to be, and there will be a very, very specific need for donor engagement in Kosovo after the status. And in this relation, I should also mention the excellent cooperation and understanding between the U.S. and the EU on Western Balkan issues. This is an area where there's perfect harmony, and I'm not saying that for reason of politeness, is really true. So to say it again, the five main points on which we have to concentrate: regional dimension has to be strengthened, open constitutional issues have to be solved, rule of law deficits have to be overcome, economic situation is improving but should further improve, and international engagement on the Western Balkans is still needed. Now to sum up two questions. First, is the political will to move ahead, And that has a EU side and it has a Western Balkan side. And the Western Balkan side, I think the problem we are facing is that populations and to a large extent also politicians are not yet totally focused on the European agenda. This is not a criticism, this is a statement. There are so many other problems which are still in their minds: economic development, also Kosovo status, recently independence of Montenegro, that we do not yet have what we experienced in the previous round of accession. At a certain moment, the total focus on European integration, which is the condition to move ahead quickly, so that the Prime Minister says to his ministers, I only want to hear about problems which delay our accession and nothing else. So we are not yet there, and again, it's not a criticism, but it is a statement, and until we are not at this stage, we will see a bit slow progress. And on our side, there are many discussions going on enlargement fatigue and interpretation of recent declarations. For me, as a long-standing commission official, for me it's not surprising that an enlargement process, accession process, for a country takes 10 or 15 years. Well, it was exactly 15 years between the fall of the Berlin Wall and the accession of Poland, so it's not surprising. And if you take into consideration that on the Balkans we have some additional problems, as I mentioned, it's not surprising that this process takes some time. I think, therefore, it is clear that after the accession of Bulgaria and Romania, what is next on the European agenda is to work on some internal reforms, which are an obligation under the treaty, to reflect on the number of commissioners, for instance, and that does not mean that any country in the Western Balkans is delayed for its accession. We are not yet at a stage that any country would accede to the Union before we will have done these internal changes. The next country, obviously, will probably be Croatia, and we hope that until by the end of this decade, this country will be ready. A lot of talking also about absorption capacity within the European Union. A colleague of mine once said that from a statistical point of view, the whole region of the Western Balkan is below the margin of statistical error. So absorbing the Western Balkans from an economic point of view or from a point of view, financial point of view, is not really the problem. The problem is how we keep the European Union functional with a very, very high number of members, and reflections are going on that, but it is not a new condition. It has been mentioned in the Copenhagen criteria since a long time. People have forgotten about that. But it doesn't make any sense to enlarge and enlarge without reflecting how the club remains functional and workable. I think that is evident. Now, I dare to conclude with a question which, in any case, you would raise, so why not anticipate that, the when question. When? Well, the when question is normally a question to which we don't answer, or we only give the answer as soon as possible. And when then in a press conference, which happens to me very often in the country, somebody insists, could you be a bit more concrete, then my second step of answer is, depends on the country, not on us. And then if somebody then still insists, I answer in a very provocative way, well, certainly during this century it will happen. Which, of course, is very impolite. As I mentioned, I think, or we think in Brussels, that Croatia could make it by the end of this decade. We hope that Serbia will find a way to make up the time lost and that the obstacles which stand in the way are removed. The main obstacle is now the ICTY cooperation. It is not normal that Serbia happens to be practically at the end of the line in the process as compared to the other countries. That is totally conflicting with its administrative and economic potential. Many countries in the region speak about 2014 as a symbolic historic date, 100 years after when the whole thing started. Well, that's fine, but all these are speculations. The policy has always been on enlargement business that we don't delay a country which is ready to move on in the accession process, and we don't offer any shortcuts. So inevitably, any answer to the question, to the when question, remains imprecise. A lot still has to be done in all the countries, but I think it is clear now to the region that the European perspective is meant seriously. We have one country coming out of the former Yugoslavia, Slovenia, which is already a member. And if Croatia moves ahead relatively quickly, that would be also a signal that this European perspective is meant seriously. But at the end, the conditions have to be fulfilled. And let me say it again, I don't think there's any readiness amongst the EU member states and the public opinion in the EU to lower the conditions for membership. Thank you.
Reinhard, you could answer a couple of questions. Why don't you stand here and please lift your hands.
Sean Schechter from the Public International Law and Policy Group. Could you just clarify some more what the EU's position is towards the status of Kosovo and what the EU would like to see happen with Kosovo?
Well, I intentionally
didn't get out in time. Yeah.
I have had in all my talks in the last 1.5 days, it was only on Kosovo, or nearly only on Kosovo, so I wanted to take a break from that. This issue, which is, of course, the most important issue at this moment, and by the way, it's also the issue where the U.S. Remains the most engaged, whereas on other Balkan issues, they have stepped out a bit. Again, it's an issue where there's no discrepancy between the EU line and the U.S. line. There's still some discrepancies between the EU and U.S. members of the contact group and Russia. The EU is totally on the line, which is also the U.S. line, that the status solution has to become very soon and very quickly. It doesn't make any sense to delay the solution of this problem. That's the first point. Secondly, there has always been, and there still is a preference for a negotiated solution, but it does not appear that a negotiated solution works out. So, and then if it doesn't work out, it has to be found, the solution has to be found in another way. The EU will, whatever the precise status of Kosovo will be, will then treat Kosovo as we do already now, as part of the stabilization and association process, so as part of the European perspective process. And that means that the EU standards on which we are insisting so much for all other parts of the region, we will also insist on Kosovo. And not everybody realizes that many issues which are being discussed in the status process, protection of minorities, are the very core of the Copenhagen criteria. And when I was last in Kosovo in July, I said to the Prime Minister, don't think that the standards which are needed to reach the status are enough to become a member of the European Union. Then the work will only start. Which in other terms also mean that to a certain extent the EU conditionalities or the EU conditions to moving ahead should also be a guarantee for some basic elements of the future status of Kosovo. Now, on the status itself, where the European Commission is rather acting in the background and Mr. Solana and his team are more in the foreground in the discussion in the contact group, what is important to have a certain degree of clarity what the status is. And to explain what I mean is to move Kosovo on later on under its new status in the European integration process, they need treaty-making powers with us. We don't want to have a status where Kosovo is not able to conclude an association agreement, for example. They need to have treaty-making powers in relation to the World Bank and to the IFIs. So that needs to be made clear. And, of course, we also have a preference for a status arrangement where we will not enter afterwards into a phase where each of our 27 member states then will decide on their own if they recognize the new Kosovo status or not. So that we need a certain degree of clarity. That's what is needed, as you say, from our point of view. And just after the status, all the donors have to get together to work on the huge challenge in relation to foreign assistance to this new thing which will come out of the status process.
Okay, maybe, excuse me, maybe one more, please.
Oh, it's okay.
Oh, you're saying for time. Yeah. I thought you had a question. I'm sorry. Please, over here.
Yes, hi. I'm Matthew Murray with the Center for Business Ethics in St. Petersburg, Russia. A question about your points concerning the rule of law and the political will required to adapt to EU standards. To some extent, the anti-corruption efforts in the region have become mired in partisan warfare. Oftentimes, political parties take a position which is designed to sort of put the other party on the defensive and personify the issue by putting somebody under the spotlight. What are you advising the countries in the region in terms of how to navigate through that process so as to avoid it becoming too partisan and focus on the merits of the problem?
Well, I think your question touches upon a broader issue. What we very often observe, and those in the audience coming from the country don't take this wrongly and badly. You know me all that I'm always speaking openly. We still see in the countries, and that again is not a criticism but just a statement, a lack of governance and democratic culture. It's not always a problem of rules and constitutional articles, but it's just how do you behave under setup. And maybe the Albanian situation in a certain way is a good example. We don't have any problems with the Albanian constitution. we have some problems when we read in reports from our embassies or newspapers that former prime ministers are jumping on the table of the parliament, that you cannot prevent by constitutional rules, but it's just a question what you don't do, but which needs some education. Sorry for citing one example from one country, it's always a mistake. I could cite other examples. So we need to work on something which we call governance and democratic culture. And there, a country like the U.S. is so important because you have beyond your constitutional rules, you have a tradition. I'm coming from a country which is quite a new constitution, only 50 years old or 60 years old, while we are starting to have a certain tradition. If a chancellor in the evening of elections says, well, I have won the elections despite the fact that the percentages are the opposite, then he gets feedback immediately and that you don't do that. So and corruption is an area where there's a lot of talking, like I did just now, but quite a high degree of helplessness what really to do. And I think the way forward, in my view, is to first concentrate on certain areas in the public administration which are particularly sensitive and where it is very important not to have corruption or to have less corruption, the customs services, the tax services, and the judiciary, and not to dream of a situation that corruption can be abolished totally. We have corruption in our own member states, and you might have corruption in the U.S. as well. But to reduce the degree of corruption and to build up the awareness that this is a criminal offense and not a normal behavior, and to concentrate on some areas first, which are very important. That would be the advice I would give on this particular issue. Well, one further question, and then I have to go.
I think there was one more here. Probably a follow-up to Albania.
No.
No? Okay.
A very quick one. This week, the Council of Europe's Parliamentary Assembly called upon the European Union to become party of the European Convention on Human Rights. What is the position of the European Commission on that call and also on the possibility of the Union to become part of the Framework Convention on National Minorities of the Council of Europe? Thank you.
Oof, that is for 2 hours. It's a particular interesting issue for a lawyer. These are our old friends in Strasbourg, the two oldest organizations, European organizations, the Council of Europe and the European Union. To give you a very brief answer, it's not a real problem, because despite the fact that the European Union is not formally, as far as I remember, formally a member of the European Convention on Human Rights, has not prevented our Court of Justice to say practically that the standards of the European Convention for European Rights applies also for the European institutions. So the standard of protection of individual rights, property rights, freedom of profession, and data protection, interesting subject to discuss in this country. All these issues, we are practically, without being formally in the convention, we are practically on the standards of human rights, of the European Convention of Human Rights, and our new constitution, which one day we will adopt, incorporates into the constitution the standards of human rights.
Okay, thank you very much, Reinhard. Thank you.
You
for coming, and you're always welcome here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.